Welcome to Fully Boosted. This is episode 110 of War Machine Horns Podcast. I'm Brad.
I'm Pete.
And I'm also Brad.
Oh. He's Matt, but we'll call him Brad, you know, if he wants. So we are Ryan and Grantless today, but we still have the three of us schlubs. And we're here to talk about War Machine stuff. So, guys, how we been? Any exciting games we played recently?
I have not played anything in a week and a half, I think. I did play like 10 games in my head, though. King of Nothing, King of Nothing under Bump with two Naslayers max units with command attachments and three Clockatrices is really getting some work done. I definitely am going to start trying out the Grave Ghoul. Because there's some interesting tech. The Grave Ghoul can pick up corpses that die no matter what. It's not restricted to enemy attack. So you can do some fun stuff with madcaps and throwing fire bombs at them, have the Grave Ghoul pick it up. So that's been working really well in my head dojo. Matt, what have you been up to?
I have no response to that.
Okay.
I mean, as long as we're dwelling in the realms of our heads, like, I guess you just played more games than I have, Pete.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, when you're camping on Memorial Day weekend, that's all you can do. I'm not saying I, you know, mapped out the fucking new King of the Hill scenario in the dirt, but I may have done that.
So as far as I go, I've been playing a lot of mercs lately, and I'm currently practicing a lot of Bartolo Montador and Damiano. Having a really good time just playing with swabbers and different like compositions of lists, testing out different things into different matchups. It's been a really fun testing environment.
Does a flamenco guitar play in your head every time you say Bartolo Montabar?
Montador?
Yeah, yes. You said Pete was not it.
No, that was not it.
you know, no, it doesn't actually. Okay. Every time I say it, it's like the beginning of Thunderstruck by AC/DC that plays.
Gotcha.
Yep.
Gotcha. Have you been doing any testing with like Blockader with Bart or anything interesting? Double Colossal?
Yeah, so like we have the tech coming up this in like a week and a half here. So like the Blockader's not gonna be out for it, so I'm not testing too much with it, but I did get a few games with it and it felt fantastic. The current Bart list I'm running is four swabbers, a freebooter, and a mariner, and then like some solos, units, whatever, Italian charter, and it's really strong and really enjoyable. To swap the Blockader in, you lose the mariner and the swabber and two swabbers, and you gain a freebooter in the exchange and how the points work. And it's really good. So you end up with this like flank with a blockader that's just like spraying dudes and it has hot shot and is great. And then a flank with double swabber, double freebooter. So you end up with like this really, really powerful, like, kind of like a uniform line of presence that you can all of a sudden like blockader charges in with its 4-inch reach and rocket fists, does a bunch of work. And then like Bart feats and fail charges and hits the back of it. And then, like, nothing that's not steady can attack the Blockader. It's pretty dope.
Wow. Sounds good. Bradley, what you been playing?
I've been doing my best Matt impersonation and playing that old Denegra 2 Black Industry list. And it's a party. That list is a lot of fun.
I love that list.
Yeah, it's still a lot of fun. So I'm playing that and also just playing Lich 2 again, and that's mostly just because I want to. Testing the new Bane UAs. They've been more impactful than I would have given them credit for just looking at their card, which now in retrospect, like, I think I'm a little bit of an idiot, and like will just further continue to echo home like the don't kind of poo-poo things until you try them. Repo 3 for them is huge. The mini feed has been mildly underwhelming, but still forces people to either under or over commit. Like, some people just won't go into them. Some people will plan to send an extra because I'm going to defensive strike the ones that come in first. That has been so far pretty great. But the biggest thing, like all of those things aside, the ability for not only for them to move through each other like with practice maneuvers, but for your anything friendly faction to move through them as well has been absolutely huge. So, like, what I've been able to do with it is, like, position the unit, not so much that they're like, really vulnerable, but what I'm able to do is play the desecrators that I have on the list more aggressively, directly behind them, and my order of activations next round is pretty free in that the Bane Knights, of course, have Ghostly, the Desecrator has Pathfinder, and being able to move through the Bane Knights with the Desecrator means that I can go in really whatever order I'd like. So that's also been kind of cool.
Hmm. Interesting. Very cool.
Yeah, so those two have been the things I've been playing and practicing and testing the most. I don't know why I started playing Matzenegger 2 list again, but it just, I just wanted to.
Makes sense. I got my James, I think that's how you pronounce it, from the Privateer Press art book Kickstarter. I think it arrived last week. So I just got her built and painted, and I'm going to be trying her out this weekend, basically just putting her in every single list just to see what it's like before I lose her to my mercenary playing son.
So. I swear that when you sent the photo of it, that yours just arrived painted.
No, no. But it was, just let me take a quick segue. The construction of the model, the design of it, was pretty nice to build. I think this is a new method that Privateer Press is employing, where the head had like a keyed polygon type of mounting for it, where it could go one of two ways, but it gave a lot of surface area for the glue to stick. And then the arms went into the torso. It had a full ball joint with a post that went deep into the torso. So it's almost like it comes with its own type of pinning. And I was just super impressed with how quickly it went together. And then, of course, you know, it's a silver model, so I was able to paint it pretty quickly. So, but yeah, I'm excited to get her on the table and see what she does.
Nice. I've been building a lot of the new Mercs models, obviously, since I have a bajillion of them, because I've been playing Mercs, and they've gotten, I think it's like 600 new releases in the last 3 weeks. Can anyone check that? I think it's 600, right? I've just been burning money, so it's fine, but all of the new models have been an absolute pleasure to build. They're just absolutely great. I have, like, I'm putting them all together, have had zero mispacks so far. Just an absolute pleasure to build.
I don't build models, so I don't know any of that.
All right.
I just have no input here, right? Like, I see Pete, like, a painting clinic. We'll get a model. he'll post a photo of the box, and then, like, within an hour, like, I'm at work, he just has a photo of it painted. I was like, we always message him back, like, Pete, aren't you at work right now? I was like, yeah, I just, you know, did it. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
I was at his house once, and I remember seeing him paint when I was there, so I believe that he can, but I just think he gets the models mailed to him painted. It's too quick now. Like, it's almost not believable. I think he was only painting in front of me to, like, put up the facade that he, like, did it himself.
No, I definitely needed to do that. Yep.
Which, like, I was impressed, but, like, now it just feels like it's, like, too much. So I don't believe it anymore. I've seen through it.
Math checks out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm in on this. I think Pete doesn't actually paint models. I think PP just mails it directly to him.
Right, like, he gets the studio painted stuff? Like, that just makes sense to me.
No, it's not studio. But yeah, I believe we wanted to talk about team tournaments, right?
And your prowess with painting, but team tournaments and, especially.
Yes, and my prowess with painting, of course. But yeah, so team tournaments. I believe the big thing, we were talking prior to the cast about what's getting us excited. And you mentioned team tournaments because... down in the Molly Whopper territory, they're running the Store Wars tournament series, right?
So they revamped a little bit this year. They had trouble getting everyone available for the qualifiers last year. What they effectively did last year is they held two qualifying events where they're going to take the top four teams from each event into this finals round. It's a lot of players to to put together five-man teams, and it's also a lot of schedules to, like, try and get everyone together to be free on the same day. So the finals was basically, if you showed up to one of the qualifiers, you got in, right? Because, like, you can only qualify once. Like, once the first qualifier happened, the second one occurred. So there's teams there that wanted to play again because they were all free. So they couldn't qualify at that point. And there's only so many teams in the field when it's teams of five. So instead of doing the qualifying rounds ahead of time, or instead of doing qualifying rounds this year, it's just jumping straight to the finals. It was an open event. They had the store that they hold it in is gigantic. So I don't know if they could have held more, but there is eight teams for this year's Store Wars again. And just with scheduling the way it is, the Philadelphia teams and like the Mark Howard teams are not represented. So this is, with the exception of Rich and I coming down to be one of the teams in that area, all of those players, the 38 players, are all from that, like, Maryland, D.C. area. So, like, a really strong, still thriving meta that if anything, is only getting larger because the teams that were coming down last year are not there this year just due to scheduling.
Wow. Yes. That's really dope.
Yeah, so it's just it's going to be a three-round, five-man team event held at Huzzah Hobbies. It's a really great community. I'm really looking forward to it. Win, lose, doesn't really matter. It's going to be a really great day. Don't get me wrong, our team's going to try to win, but, like, regardless of outcome, it's going to be great. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. And Huzzah Hobbies is just a great store. I always enjoy going to that store.
And then, Matt, I feel like you have something coming up team-wise as well.
Yes, we have the tech coming up here in a couple weeks, in a week and a half. I think it's on the 8th of June. So it's a 16-man team event, 5-man teams. Mm-hmm. Bunch of teams from all across Canada. I'm not sure how many American teams are coming anymore. I thought it was a few. Now I'm not sure at all.
Yeah, sadly. Well, good news. One of our teammates was able to get a new job with a pretty big promotion, so we're really happy for him. And then it just our team kind of just fell apart, and that's fine. You know, it's going to happen. So sadly, the Soretis will not be invading Canada for the tech.
Yeah, yeah. Which makes me very sad. I'm a sad Matt to not get my fix of the Soretis. With that said, though, it's a pretty big event. I know my WTC team, minus Chris Stancox, is going to be there. I think all of Canada Team 2, whatever their name is this year, is going to be there, except for maybe one person. It's going to be a good event.
Are Marc-André LeBlanc and Mathieu Messier going to be there?
Yes, they're on different teams. But yeah.
That event's a party, then.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Is it still held in the same spot in Montreal on like that Air Force base?
Yes, it's on the military base in Long Point.
Yes, I mean, I was there last year with personal trips this year and traveling for other War Machine events. Like, I couldn't make it this year. I'd like to next year if at all possible. But I remember that event being great. And really, kind of just from Matt talking about that event, us talking about Star Wars, and then the Volcro Brawl, which is coming up in October as well. Matt's WTC, ATC on the horizon, just a lot of team event talk, which all got us to hang to each other. It's almost our preferred format. At least I will say that for myself. I don't know if we said this ahead of time, but like if I had the option of traveling for like the weekend steamrollers that I'm able to go to and instead go to five-man team events, I think, always choose five-man team events.
So it's weird, right? So, like, I think initially I used to really not like team events at all. Back when, like, I was like trying really hard to like find success and all those things. Like, team events always felt like I was on a team of people who didn't have the same expectations I did and didn't have the same kind of like desires I did, and it always led to like this really weird like. I would go X and O or X and 1, and the rest would go 2 and X or whatever, right? X and 2 or X and 3. And it always looks like really weird, like our team would just get stomped and we'd get just like mercilessly fucked. And I would just be like, guys, come on, we can do better. Let's try to win the event, kind of a thing. And like as I started being with different teams and experiencing different kind of like play styles and expectations, I realized that like team events are the single greatest event in War Machine as long as you meet like this criteria of be on a team with like-minded individuals that you enjoy hanging out with. I think that's the really big thing is like as long as you're with people you're having fun with and you all have the same goals in mind, team events are the single best format. They're amazing. There's no better feeling than when you lose a game and you look down the table and three of your teammates give you thumbs up. Like, you're just like, ah, yeah, me losing didn't matter. That's what that's like the highlight of team events for me.
Is being able to lose games and still win.
Yeah, exactly. being the anchor around my team's neck as I drag them down. Yeah. No, like just the like having faith in your teammates, like team events can be really fun. Like if you go and just like have like a couple drinks and have a good time, like a team upset East Ready Spaghetti at a Boker Brawl last year.
Just out of curiosity, guys, for the 2019 Boker Brawl, does anyone know when the registration opens?
I believe it is June 1st.
June 1st registration opens for Boker Brawl.
Yeah, so that's like that's Saturday.
Yeah, it's like now basically. Like, not yet.
Yep.
I'd say I will be there. The Molly Whoppers will be there. Mr. Matthew McWaters will be there. Are we flying in the Brits? Are they coming?
So Boker Brawl is the week after WTC.
Right, just have him come right to America.
Yeah.
So
I'm
taking a $1,000 flight to Europe, staying in Europe for a week, flying back to Montreal, then 2 days later, flying out to Pete's house.
Solid fucking plan.
It's going to be a busy, busy month.
I mean, yeah, but for like the rest of us non-WTC players, it's an excellent five-man team event in North Jersey, held in a VFW hall with cheap beer and food the entire weekend.
I agree. It is a great event. I had a lot of fun last year. This is not a paid promotion.
No, I mean, it's not. I'm just like, I want it to do well because it's around the corner from my house. And the bigger this event gets, the easier it is for me to get to it.
So with all that said, I think the main thing that I was talking about was that you need to be on a team that has the same expectations of you. And that's what makes team events great. With the tech coming up, I have this conversation like every week with a local, one local or another, where like they'll be like, I'm on a team, but my team is X, like it's like three people who have played one game in the last year and a half and me who plays five games a week, right? And they're like, I'm going to have a miserable time because my team's going to be bad. And I always say the same things. It's like, if that's the mentality you're going to go into it with, you're better off not attending than being the person that is, you know, an asshole to the rest of your team, right?
Yeah, there is definitely... I mean, it's a team, right? There is no I in team. You got to support your team members straight up. Like, you know,
I mean, sometimes other times you can tell them to go fuck themselves. Like,
okay. Good.
Like
good point.
You don't like, you have to support the people you want to support. Like, let's be real here. Like I'm all for being like inclusive and like supporting people and like all that shit. But like, if someone's being an asshole and like, you're like, they're like, they commit to the team event, and they're like, I'm going to give it my all. I'm going to be the guy our team needs. And then like months down the road, they've just not done anything that you expect from them. And like, they've just haven't contributed in any meaningful way. And you're just sitting there like, dude, like we got the tech in a week. Like we've had this team together for 3 months. Like what do you mean? Like you sold all your factions. You don't own models anymore.
That hasn't like, happened.
Literally happened this year.
No. That didn't happen.
That literally happened.
I just don't want to believe it.
Like not on my team, but on someone else's team. And I'm sure I was just very specific and someone's going to listen to this podcast and I'm going to get an uh-oh spaghetti-o moment. But like, let's be real here. If you're going to commit to a fucking thing, you commit to it. You don't be some wishy-washy fuckface that like hangs four other people out to dry. Like, it's not cool. Like, if you're like, hey, I'm going to commit, I'm going to be there, I'm going to work with the team, I'm going to do these things. Like, unless you go into it with the thing of, like, I'm going to go if I can, but no commitment. If you're committed, then stay committed. And if it's something that beyond your control and you can't make it, like, that's fine. Life is more important than a game, for sure. No, but, like...
I'm sorry, keep going.
Life is always more important than a game. Don't, like... But, like, if you're just like, I'm lazy... Or whatever the reason may be, it's like, come on, like, you have four other people whose times you're wasting, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to say, you know, if Letterkenny has taught us anything, it's FURTA. It's for the boys. Got to do it. FURTA.
Yeah, so with all that said, team events are super fun, and, like, they're the lowest stress events I ever attend. I've attended quite a few at this point, and every single one I go to, like, there's always that moment on the drive up where everyone's like, especially if you can drive up together in the same car, that is the golden moment. That is the best experience. You can have the one team moment. Pete knows what I'm talking about.
I don't know what this is.
That's when you're stuck picking up someone from an airport, but one of your teammates has been eating beef jerky all day, and the windows in the cars don't roll down.
Well, they do. It's just raining, and you don't want to roll them down.
So we are now one team, one family.
Yes. Things were shared. smells, tastes. So Matt, one of the things last year at the Poker Brawl, you said something that was really, you gave us the team pep talk, and it kind of resonated with me because it was neat, and you did the same thing at Captain Con. Well, do you remember what you said?
I mean, vaguely.
Okay.
So what I say is largely just like, okay, so the pep talk is like, hey guys, this is my expectation of the event. So, like, in the case of, like, I was playing with you guys, I'm like, I'm here to have fun with you guys. I don't care about your personal, like, how you personally do, whether you win or lose. All I care about is you have a good game and you're proud of how you played. At the end of the day, if that means we go 0-5 or 5-0, either is perfectly acceptable. The things to be careful of is team events can always tend to bring out the worst sportsmen in players when they're trying to win their game for someone else's sake. So I want you to be aware of that and play your best and be the best sportsman you can and watch your opponent and try to help them be the best sportsman they can as well. Did I miss anything? I think that's like the gist of what I went over.
Yep.
And I think that's kind of the thing is that in a team event, like, make your expectations clear. Make it clear that win or lose, you're here to have fun. And finally, like, support your teammates. Give them the advice they need. Help them figure things out. And, like, listen to what they have to say. Don't criticize them. Unless they need it, right? Like, if they're asking for criticism, give it to them. But, like, always support your teammates when you can. Like,
so, you didn't get to it directly, Matt, but you hinted at something that was, like, really huge for me, right? So, like, I was able to join, like, Danny, Gibbs, Justin Dew, just a handful of really solid players, as well as Donnie, just so I don't forget him, because he will definitely...
Donnie who?
Yeah, but I was able to go with them to the ATC this year, or this past year, I should say, and did objectively, like, pretty awful. It was... not a great showing for me. In total, there was 5 rounds. I went 1-4. So all throughout the course of the event, they were very quick to make sure I was not getting too down on myself, right? Like, the one thing that we'd all done in the run-up to the event is spend a lot of time practicing for the event, so we all knew how much effort all of us put in. And even though there might be a player that's falling behind or not necessarily pulling their own weight at the event, because I didn't feel like I was, they were always there to kind of pick me back up and you know, let me know that, like, you know, we can get past this, work together as a team kind of thing. And it was really reassuring, especially because I was getting really down on myself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the really big thing about team events. I know that during team events, and just like in general at events, I try to support people as hard as I can. So like, it's really weird, but like a lot of people get lost in like the competition of stuff, and like they forget like it's like they're humans on the other side of the table, and like we're just a bunch of friends trying to have a good time. So like, it's very important that like when someone fucks something up or like someone gets assassinated or whatever, it's like when they lose the game, you expected them to win or something like that. Instead of like raking them over the coals and like talking shit, you make sure to prop them back up, because if you rake them over the coals, that's going to be in their head the next time, the next round.
Right.
That's going to be in their head for every other team event they go to. Like, you can't put people down and expect them to perform. You have to support them, because like at the end of the day, if like Brad's teammates had been like, yeah, you played like shit, you suck, I guarantee you going into the next round, his confidence would have been shaken. He would have been, you know, a little bit, they would have dwelled somewhere in the back of his head. He would have felt a more stress and pressure. He would invariably have played worse.
Yeah. I don't know. Like that emotional safety net. Like, so, I mean, we had gone in there. We had, I don't know if expectations to win was the right thing, but like we went into the event attempting to do well. And I had felt like I was the reason that we were not able to. So to have team members there, like behind you that are, supportive in, what they're saying to you was really huge for me. Like, it turned into like what could have been a pretty awful event, like when I think back in retrospect, to like a really enjoyable thing that I was very happy I did. And I'm looking forward to it again this year as like an act of redemption kind of thing. Like if I go 1-4 again, oh boy. But I mean, if it happens, like it happened, like there's no way to know what all someone's ending outcome will be before you get there. But I have hopes to do better, and that's because of the team I was on. So having that around you, I think, is huge. Like, again, just trying to echo Matt's point of going in with the right expectations. Like, our expectations as we lead up to events is that everyone commits the time to practice and learn the matchups they'll be going into. So, you know, well enough that you'll be able to know if you need to dodge it or something you can go into. And then once you actually get to the table, you know, things can go a lot of different directions. You know, dice happen. People play the matchup differently than what you practiced into. Like, as long as you're putting the effort ahead of time, like, we have a really strong team structure, I think.
So I think that you touched on something, is that prepping your team, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that like one of the big things that a lot of people don't realize when they're prepping for events is like how much foresight and planning and like crafting goes into like an actual team win, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
like a lot of the time, like for team events, the teams that are best prepared are the teams that win. So like using WTC as an example, last year, our team practiced really hard. We had people practicing multiple factions. We built an entire matchup matrix and like did a bunch of testing. Like, this is the really big thing, is that building a team structure and like for team events is an iterative process. So like step one, you get an initial idea of what everyone wants to play and you get their initial like lists. And then step two, you identify all of the weaknesses that those lists potentially have. Then step three is you identify all of the like the expected meta lists that those lists are great into, and you build a matrix of all of those list matchups. And then what this basically looks like is an Excel spreadsheet of like the top meta lists and then your list lined up against them, and you rate them usually between 1 and 5. So like 1 being the worst, aka it's also called red, and green, 5 being the best, also known as a green. 5 can be like a super green or like slam dunk or whatever. And then usually yellows are 3s. And you rate the matchups. And once you have those ratings, you ask people to test them, because like obviously everyone involved in a process is going to have a different opinion and expectation of like what matchup numbers actually are. So it'll be like, using last year's spreadsheet as an example, I played Denny 2 all last year, and I had a lot of matchups rated as yellows. Not because I hadn't tested them, but because I had tested them extensively, and I knew that once a game happened on the table, it was super weird and hard to rate as a green. Had I, looking back in hindsight, most of those should have been greens, because like I was confident in myself and resolving games on the table that like those matchups were really good for me. So point ends up being that you test all those matchups, and as you test, you're going to notice that your scores change. Like, so, like you test a lot, some become greens, some become reds. And as things become reds, eventually your team captain or other members are going to be like, well, that one list has a lot of reds where it needs to have greens, and you should start looking at other lists. Mm-hmm. And over time, your pairing, your caster, your list composition, everything is going to change. And as you get to a team event, you're going to eventually have, in an ideal world, you're going to have a list of predicted meta things and your caster pairing that answers them and what you play into what. And that's what the best prepared teams do.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely right. I remember the lead up to ATC was a lot of practice days, just a mountain of practice days where we'd go through and look at different lists that placed well in previous conventions, and then would like put together all 10 of our lists. Put together all 5 of our list pairs into those kind of lists to see how many dodges we had across things we expected to see. At the time, that was right on the heels of when, and they still are, but right on the heels of when Circle really rose to its prominence. So we were all trying to figure out a strong Circle drop so that none of us had to drop what we thought was going to be one of the most popular factions in the field. But like on top of just trying to figure out what we think the meta is going to be and how to construct the team's list pairs beyond that, it's all of the practice games that lead into it to find out if your assumptions are correct. I still don't think there's a tremendous answer in Quicks for Circle, but I remember the lead up to ATC, I think I went through like 6 different lists of just trying to find something that felt good and everything. And the list I brought wasn't even the thing I ultimately landed on. As like a like Circle drop, if you will, like it's still evolving. I think it's like one of the great things with this game in general is that that there's a puzzle to solve and the answers are there if you put the time in to find it. And even if the matchup isn't necessarily in your favor, it's not like a list on list advantage to you. If you practice nearly any matchup enough, you can get it so that you know the beats of the matchup better off than your opponent. I don't know the other side of the table, but I think it was WTC, would it have been 2 years ago or last year when Greg Collinson was with Team Canada, Matt?
Last year. He was on my team.
He was on your team, perfect. So he was playing Grimkin, which is historically a pretty advantage matchup for Haley 3. And it might have been you telling me this story, but I remember he was either hearing from him or someone on his team that he had practiced the Grimkin into Haley 3 matchup countless times, just over and over and over again, kind of learning the ins and outs and everything he can do in that matchup to try and win the game. And at WTC, in the pairing process, they put forward Greg and they draw out the Signar player, them thinking... the other team that put forward the Signar player, that there would be no way Grimkin would choose Haley 3 because it's such a miserable game for Grimkin. He ends up choosing Signar, kind of throwing the other team off of their perceived way the pairing practice was going to go. And then because he practiced that matchup so extensively, was able to win a game against a perceived disadvantaged matchup. Am I just about right with the details
no.
of that story?
Greg Collinson played Haley 3 against Jake Wilstrop, and Jake Wilstrop beat him. So that doesn't sound accurate at all.
I thought he played a Haley 3 player in 1. Was this at OTC maybe then?
Maybe. Definitely wasn't at WTC.
I know it's a team event where that all came up.
Probably. Definitely wasn't at WTC though.
All right, so potentially OTC. I know it was a team event where I kind of heard the ins and outs of that, which I thought was pretty astounding. Because, I mean, as you were saying, Matt, like... I know we did, I know you guys did, and I presume most teams will do like a pairing matrix just so you know what players are looking to dodge where and where they're and what matches they'd like to land in. And if you have a Signar player and you raid a green matchup thing you're looking for in Grimkin, and the opposing Grimkin player is, to your surprise, also looking for that matchup because they're so experienced in it and feel well versed in it, it can really throw off what matchups you should or should not be looking for potentially.
Yeah, so practice is one of the biggest things. The whole thing about practicing team events and all that stuff is that as you play a matchup more and more and more, and you really like learn the ins and outs of it, you can find advantages where you're normally disadvantaged. So like a really good example of this is watching Josh, my team captain from last year, play against a Kruger player. Going into the matchup, Josh was like, I can't lose this matchup. It's so good for me. And then, like, on turn two, he's basically tabled. And he's like, I've never lost this matchup before. And his opponent's like, yeah, I changed my, like, my build's not the standard build, and I've played your version of your list a bunch of times. So, like, I knew all, how that list was going to unpack, and I knew how to take it apart. And, like, that's what that power can do. With all of that said, though, I think a big thing to state is that you never know what the other team is going to be dropping into you.
Right.
Like, you have no idea what they're thinking. And I think that's a really big point that a lot of people miss, because, like, just, like, taking OTC as an example, when we played against you, Brad.
Yep.
Our team caught, like, we were going through, like, a little bit after the games talking about things, and you were telling me the ratings where people thought they were favored in some spots, and you were like, oh, I got all my team greens and all that stuff like that. And I was like, oh, I also got all of my team greens.
Well, that's not possible.
Well, that's not possible. So one of us is fucking wrong. And I think that's kind of the thing, the scope of it, right? Like, you try your best to be as accurate and have faith in your players as much as you can. And like, having faith in your players is a double-edged sword, right? Like, you could have as much faith in Billy Bob as you want. Like, he's going to win that bad matchup. But like, you still don't want to give it to him. Like, you want to protect your team and get them winnable games, right?
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Mine was just, I remember in the lead up to ATC again, we were going through and practicing games, and two of my teammates were kind of rating the matches into each other, and both independently rating the match advantaged. I was like, guys, that's not possible. You both can't be advantaged into each other. And they still could not agree on who was actually advantaged in that game, because they both felt confident in the matchup.
At WTC last year, Jeremy and I had the same interaction, Animag versus Scar 3, and I was like, I think it's a 5 for Scar 3, and he's like, well, I think it's a 4 for Animag, and I was like, well, my 5 supersedes your 4, that means it's a 1 for you.
I don't think that's how it works.
But it is actually how it works on the table. So anyways, we resolved that at WTC, and it was a fun experience. Point ends up being, though, so we've talked about matchmaking and like getting reads on matchups and practicing and all that stuff. I think one of the other big things we have to talk about is like the day of the team event. Actually playing team events and like being a part of your team, mm-hmm, means being like be an active member. Don't just be like a sitter by and watch other people and watch them make decisions. Like, go look at tables, get opinions on terrain, figure things out. Because in like the 5-man WTC format team events, one team's picking matchups and the other team's picking tables.
Yep.
And so picking tables can be a really powerful position to be in. I think the really big thing, when you're looking at terrain and like thinking about matchups and stuff like that, is a lot of the times you can pick terrain that will allow a bad matchup to be a good matchup. I know at ATC, we chose tables every round we could. I think we ended up choosing them 4 out of 5 or 5 out of 6, whatever the number of rounds were. And it worked out really great for us. I mean, we won the event, but like we also were able to swing matchups with tables fairly reliably. I know we got Chris Dancock's tables for King of Nothing, where he could just Host of Shadows his heavies through houses every single round.
That's rough.
Yeah, it's that's the money right there. So I mean, it like team events are essentially five solo events, like a five-man solo event. I'm saying this wrong. Picture it like this. You have five independent players all playing on tables, but you can shield them from their worst matchups.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way team events work.
The other thing with that is you can't do it with every player. But one of the other neat things is there, especially on a team of five, you can have one player bring some really like off the wall, kind of like hard skew. If you can keep them out of the few things that list usually needs to dodge. You can't do that with the entire team because eventually you're going to have some players hitting their dodges. But like one team, like one member on that team can really play something kind of spectacular, which was at least I think for us at ATC was actually Donnie on Kalos 2. I mean, it was pretty hyper-targeted for Menoth. And then Kalos 1 is generally gets to play in everything. But I mean, at the time, Kalos 2 was at least, unless I'm mistaken, I don't believe all that widely considered to be like a viable drop into a lot of things.
I mean, Kalos 2 was a super teched out choice, and I think people are aware of it, but like no one's playing it, right?
Right.
And like I think that's what I think you want to be doing. So like a lot of like WTC prep and like actual team events is identifying those like dark horse casters that are good and bring solid solves to problems, but aren't things people have that meaningful practice against. And I think that's a really big thing to talk about is like, so a lot of the time what ends up happening is people lock onto like really powerful lists and casters that are like what I call obviously powerful, like Iona or like Animag PT when she came out, or like Gatsby 3-9 Slayers. They're very obviously powerful, but like everyone's teching for them and practicing against them. And in a team event, like that's like you get to dictate so much of like the pairing process because you have those lists. But also having like a really weird list that no one has any practice against at all and is like completely off the wall, and but like you're the best player of it in your area, like when I played Denny 2 as an example, and like no one had any practice against Denny 2, and like they'd get to the table and like they'd be like, okay, can you explain to me how she works? Like, can you? Yeah. One of like, as a quick story, one of my favorite moments in all of WTC is I think it's like round 2 or 3, and I get to the table and I'm like, I'm dropping Denny 2, and the guy hasn't even like said his list yet. Like, I just shout, I'm dropping Denny 2, and he's like, okay, well, I guess I'm dropping this. I'm like, you got it, man. And like, he's like, okay, can I see your card?
Oh boy.
And I'm like, yeah, you're gonna get assassinated. There's a 0% chance you live through this game. And that's what happened. I dark banished his caster into a waiting death jack. And like, those things can be really powerful because of how team formats work, people usually hyper focus on getting practiced against other team format lists like Iona and stuff like that. And so like bringing something that's a little off meta means that people aren't practiced, and you can find those little knowledge and muscle memory advantages against people that don't exist in other places. This does apply to solo events and conventions and pretty much everything at all. If you find something that's really good for you, even though it may not be obviously powerful for other people, it doesn't mean that it's bad. It means that you found something that maybe other people haven't locked onto yet. So play what excites you. Pro tip.
Mm-hmm. I think all the fun and soul events you can find in team events, but the camaraderie that comes with it is like, you don't find that in soul events, right? Like if you do well in soul events, like, you know, it feels great, but like the winning and playing as a team and the whole build up to the event, is just tremendously enjoyable. They're really tough to organize. Again, like I was saying, getting everyone scheduled together and finding space for all of it and put together. But like, if you have the ability to play in them, you know, the local ones we're describing, whether it's like TQ or OTC or down by us for Store Wars or Poker Brawl, like you don't like WTC is of course like the kind of crown jewel, like the top of the top. You don't necessarily have to do that one. Just find a team event if there isn't one by you, and you have a regional central spot for a couple different metas. Like, just try to pull one together yourself. You don't need to rent a gigantic space. You don't need tremendous prize support. But like, the event itself is enough fun on its own that it's 100% worth running if you don't have one near you.
Yeah, I agree. The team events are great. They're just an absolute blast. I mean, they're the most fun I ever have with War Machine.
So, I know we spent a lot of time on team events. Is there anything else we want to try and add to this before we kind of move on to the couple other things we want to talk about tonight?
Yeah, so maybe Pete can give us this, like, a little bit of a story here, but like, we had like a sportsmanship and clock management question.
Yeah, so basically, at one of our a local event, we heard that there was a story of like the last round, the last round of the tournament, the top table game. There was some contention with people passing clocks and scoring and how that all works, etc. So, what it prompted, it prompted me to do a deep dive into the rules and try to figure out where it all happens, right? When do you score? Whose clock is it on? When do you pass the clock? When do you write down the score? When that stuff happens? Because I've seen it both ways. I've seen it where, you know, I end my turn. I say, okay, I score one here, the score's 2-0. And then I pass my clock, and I've had it where my opponent has stood up, passed the clock, and say, I score nothing, you score 2. And I know that way felt a little weird. And it's usually not a big problem because I'm always under the mindset that, like, you can pretty much tell after, you know, at a certain point how the game is going to go, and there's no reason to, you know, create a big issue about it. So, thoughts on that right now?
So, sportsmanship's really weird, and rules are really weird. And oftentimes, playing by the rules as written doesn't make for good sportsmanship. And War Machine is all about intention and not being a giant piece of shit. Except for when the other person's being a giant piece of shit, then it's okay. But point ends up being, I don't care what the rules say. I don't care about flipping clock, all of that shit. Like, whatever it says in the rule book, don't care. I think the intention is the important thing. And I think that as long as two players are playing a game where one player isn't purposely trying to clock the other person by taking up time off their clock and flipping the clock to them whenever they breathe or do anything, I think that largely clock situations are fine. But what does end up happening as we get closer into the bottom of the game, so like we're talking like people have less than a minute left on their clock, maybe they have 30 seconds left, you get some really weird, sloppy clock things where people just start slapping the clock for everything, trying to make their opponent clock out or trying to save their own time. I think that in situations like this, the optimal thing to do, and I'm sure tournament organizers are going to hate me for saying this, but like I do it every convention or tournament I go to, is when that scoring situation comes up, I just pause the clock for the 3 seconds. Like, my opponent flips the clock and says, I score 2, your turn, after he flips the clock, of course. I just pause the clock. I'm like, let's mark that down. Don't flip the clock to me until you're done with your turn. And then we'll flip the, like, and then I'll start my turn. I'll restart the clock, obviously. And I think, like, that's just the little bit of a cleaner way to do it. Because as much as death clock and all that stuff is good for the game and helps create a dynamic and interesting environment, the low clock time sportsmanship is always some of the worst I've ever seen.
So I actually, Matt, I think I do the same thing, though it's not at the end of every turn when you start scoring is when I'd be doing it. So, like, at least for me, when I go to end my turns, I'll kind of announce who's scored what as, like, I'm reaching for the clock. And then usually opponents will nod, agree, like, they'll do something to, like, confirm they've heard you, at which point is when I hit the clock, and during the first couple, like, you know, leech this fury, allocate this focus, power up, whatever, I just real quick and do the tally marks in those first couple seconds. As the game gets down to the winding last few seconds, I'll do the same thing you were describing. You know, you pause the clock for that, you know, real quick 2 seconds, confirm what the points are, go ahead and mark them down, and then start the clock up again. I haven't had any complaints from any opponents. I've been in less situation. I've been in fewer situations where I've had like a table judge than you have. I'm sure, just in terms of like the profile of the game. But in the few times I've had, I have not had a complaint about that in that situation either. It just makes everything easier, and makes it so that like it doesn't ever appear like I'm trying to take time off my opponent by flipping the clock to them and then going over what the points are, like having them confirm on their time kind of thing. Like, just get it done and then keep going with the game.
So one of the big things with clock time is it's really weird, like with like dice rolls and stuff. So like Tough and Martyrdom and like triggers and stuff, mm-hmm. it can get really weird and like just like generally be really fucky. And like, recently locally I had a practice game, and like normally I don't get frustrated during practice games. Like, I'm there to have fun and test things. But I was playing a guy who was like taking tough checks and taking forever to fucking roll the die. Like taking like, I don't know, 8+ seconds to roll a tough check. I'm just like sitting there staring. I'm just like, all right, I went through 2 turns of this, and like, I'm forcing like 10, 15 toughs a turn, right? And I'm just like staring at this. I'm just getting progressively more tilted by it. And I'm like, okay. So I pause the clock and I say, look, if you're going to take tough checks that are like, if you're going to take over a second or two to take a tough check, I'm going to flip the clock to you while you're taking it and flip it back immediately when you're done. And like, I just have my hand over the clock ready to flip it back and forth. Right. And like, I haven't had to do that for forever. Like, I never flip the clock during toughs. Almost ever. I'll flip it during, like, decision points. Like, are you going to martyr that model? Right. I'll flip it really quick and then be like, do you martyr? And then he'll be like, no, and I'll flip it back. But, like, mm-hmm. almost never do I flip it for toughs. Usually people are very fast on it. But, like, it's such a weird thing. Because, like, I get asked about it all the time and I talk about it all the time. Like, I interact with it all the time. It's just a really weird thing. Like, what's your threshold, Brad? How long do you wait before you flip the clock to your opponent?
I think it would have to be a like continued pattern through the game. I have never started a game or like off the cuff at the beginning of the game, been in the practice of flipping the clock to my opponent for the, you know, for tough checks or when you're playing against Harvey for Martyrs. But if through the course of the game, it's all down to feel. If it just doesn't feel right, I think I would verbally let them know ahead of time, like, I'm going to start, I got to start flipping to you here. Like, this is just, you either got to go quicker, or I got to start flipping to you. But that has literally never occurred. Like, I don't know if I've ever felt like someone was trying to take advantage of me in that regard. And, like, just on my own, like, how I usually do it is as soon as you declare a model of mine that has, like, sorry, let's start since over. As soon as you declare attack against a model of mine that has tough, I put a die in my hand, right? Like, as soon as your dice fall, that would show, like, you've broken armor. I'm dropping my die out of my hand for a tough roll, right? Like, declared the attack. I know it's going to have to happen if you break armor.
Yep. No, I always have my dice right there. And I'll even, especially playing like the 6 Clockatrice list or something that has a lot of moving pieces. If they're like, I'm attacking that guy and it takes me a long time to like, find the thing to mark, I'll flip it to me and like give a 3 count and then flip it back, just so that I don't feel like I'm stealing time from my opponent.
Yeah. I think that like, I mean, I think most people who do tough quickly do it the same way, right? Like, as soon as someone starts attacking, you just start rolling the dice. Like, you're just like, oh, you killed them all tough. Sure.
Yep.
I think the more important thing is like the sportsmanship behind when it's okay to flip the clock to your opponent. Like, I think all three of us, like, I've played each of you guys, and, like, we've played multiple times, and I've never had a sportsmanship issue, never had, like, any kind of time issue or anything like that. And I think that we all have the same mentality when we approach it. It's that during my turn, like, as a player, my turn, I don't expect you to have to flip the clock to you because it's my turn. If you do something that feels bad to me, now I have to flip the clock to you. And during your turn, I don't expect you to flip the clock to me unless I do something stupid or I take a long time. Then flip the clock to me. It's like, that's a fair assessment.
I think so. Like, I mean, Matt, when you and I played, we both, the last time I played, I think, we both had lists that had a lot of tough in it, and I don't remember either of us flipping back and forth to each other for any of that.
Correct. Yeah, we played two bricks of tough dudes with 30 to 40 models on either side, and just like, we're just like rolling dice. Pro tip, I ended up clocking out in that game.
Did you really?
Yeah, that's how you won, because I like, it was impossible for me to win anyways. Like, I could play more turns, but I couldn't win. But I did run out of clock time, losing.
I'll take a word for it. I don't remember. I remember being a really tight, grindy scenario game, but clock or scenario, I don't remember actually how it ended. So,
well, I mean, you would have won on scenario if I didn't clock out. That's literally how the...
Ah-ha-ha. All right. I just remember that game being great, but for how the conversation was going, I had 30 plus tough models, so did you. Do either of us have any moving parts on each other's turn?
That was Haley 3, and it was Jake Wilstrop's list, so yeah. Probably not.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't even remember any contentious counter-charging play. I think if it was ever an opportunity that was going to come up, you would put it to me and say, do I want to? And then I would answer no and flip it back, or yes and take it or whatever.
Yeah, so Barathrum, right?
Yep.
So, I'd move a model into Barathrum's range, and I'd be like, do you want a countercharge? Flip it to you. Keep the hand on the clock. Mm-hmm. And you'd be like, no, and I'd flip it back immediately.
Right. I mean, that does mean, though, that, you as an opponent have to be mindful of what your opponent's triggers are, which isn't always the easiest thing. But, if there's only a few of them, or if you are able to be mindful of them, anytime there are those decision points, I kind of expect my opponent to flip it to me, and I would hope that they would, right? I'd much rather them do that than for them to move on to the next thing and for me to, have to, jump down their throat reaching for the clock to, well, I'm doing a thing before it's, too late.
Yeah, at the Sioux, that happened to me a few times. Playing Toros with Damiano. There'd be, that moment where my opponent would do something, he'd go to move his next model, and I'd be like, no, stop, I'm going to countercharge.
Right.
That always sucks. I know with Grimkin, Arcana could be really awkward too. Mm-hmm. Pete, how have you been handling Arcana?
When to declare him?
Yeah, are you pausing the clock when you declare it? What are you doing?
No, I will definitely, depending on the impact, if it's something that is, for instance, Labyrinth, right? That is something that will affect, the rest of the turn. And it's something that has to be measured. So what I'll do is, most of the time I'm having a discussion with my opponent anyway, I could trigger Labyrinth, and I'll measure the distance on my clock. So just so that we can see, and then I'll be like, no, I'm not going to trigger it. And I flip it back. But anytime I'm doing any type of thinking, it's on my clock,
Yeah, I think that's the really big thing, is that anytime a decision has to be made or you get to think, you really need to put it on your time. Mm-hmm. I had to explain to someone that it's not okay to measure your own movement during my time recently. It's just really bad form. And they're like, well, there's nothing that says I can't do that. And I was like,
real quick, Matt, I just want to make sure I'm understanding. Do you mean proxying out some moves they'd be making? Or just measure? Okay, so that's not as great. But I have 100% measured things on my opponent's time. As long as I'm available to my opponent and not getting in their way and not slowing them down, I have 100% taken out sticks and am I within 10 of that thing? No. Is real quick, am I within 4 of the objective to give this guy Pathfinder for my next turn? I've done that.
So I'm not super cool with that. I think we all kind of do it at some point, but, it's, a really weird thing to me. You're using your opponent's time to actually get measurements and data. It's weird. I don't think that's okay. But, if I'm playing a game and my opponent, on the opposite side of the table, puts down a 14-inch stick and puts down a proxy base in the middle of the turn?
Yeah, I mean, that seems objectively not as great.
Yeah, like, I'm just like, what the fuck was that? Like, I always have, like, a weird thing, because, like, I feel like during your opponent's time, all you should be doing is, like, being a conscientious opponent and, like, helping them and watching what they're doing. You shouldn't be using their time for your advantage.
Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of brings back to what I was saying, was, like, I'm still going to be available for my opponent. Like, I'm still there listening to them, but, like, those real quick, simple measurements, I 100% know I've taken.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can't say I haven't taken them myself. I'm for sure have at some point. It's just one of those weird things. Whenever it happens to me, I notice it and I think about it. Like, that's really, it's a weird thing, right? Like, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think the next time we play, I'm going to make it a point to measure just pointless things, just command range on units I know what? We're in.
I mean, like, that's the other thing, too. Like, I mean, no, like, that's the other thing. Like that's the other side of it, too. Like, you measure some stupid measurement, and now during my turn, you've disrupted my entire train of thought. Like, I feel like that's fucked up, too.
Right, I get that. I was, my comment was to fuck with you, bud.
I know, no, I understand that, but that reminded me of something, Brad. So I think, like, the whole thing with time management, like, being a friendly opponent and stuff like that in general is, like, if you wouldn't like it being done to you, don't do it to your opponent, right? Like, right. If you're sitting there like, man, it's really annoying when he flips the clock to me every time I have to put damage on my fucking warjack. Like, don't do that to your opponent. And if someone's doing that to you and you don't like it, maybe bring it up instead of sitting there and, like, being super passive-aggressive. Because, like, as a community, it's up to us to kind of determine what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And if, like, you just sit there and take the beating and just, like, brood silently and, like, become rage-filled and then, like, go post up a hateful post on Facebook about it. Like, that person doesn't learn anything. He doesn't ever have that valuable interaction where someone says, like, hey, by the way, Bob, I really didn't like the way you handled this. Do you think you could, like, do it this way?
Right.
Because, like, we've all done it. Like, we all have different histories and backgrounds. We've all done something where, like, someone along the way had to tell us, like, you can't do that. Like, please don't do that. That's kind of rude, right?
Yes.
So, I think that, like, especially with the clock thing, like, if you're in the finals, or you're in, like, any game at all, and, like, two players are low on clock, and you're trying to clock out someone, and you're, like, you're just, like, I flip the clock to you, then I take advantage of the fact that I flip the clock to you to do stuff that I should be doing on my time, you're an asshole. And you shouldn't do that. Conversely, if you're flipping the clock to the other person to try to grind them down, you're also an asshole. You shouldn't do that. Just play the game and be the best sportsman, friend, competitor you can be. Winning a game and being an asshole to win it makes that win cheap and not worth it.
I mean, for you. I mean, I'll win anyway I can.
Your record really shows it.
Got him.
I mean, like, I think this is the big thing. It's like, if you ever watch some really high-level games of War Machine played, like really good players who, like, respect each other and play, like, at a really high level, you'll see that no one's ever doing that shit. Like,
right.
Clock, like, they're just taking their time, talking about what's happening, being very vocal, and, like, if there's ever an issue with something, they pause the clock, they get a judge when they need it, shit like that. Like, just be a good opponent. Don't do things to try to fuck over your opponent. That's what dickheads do. Don't be a dickhead.
No, I mean, you're spot on. Like, this game, and really any miniature game, right? Like, anything you're going to leave your house and either go to someone else's house or go to a store to play a game has, like, some level of a social contract to it. And just, like, throwing all of that out the window for the sake of winning is not at all worth the trip out of your house.
I agree. Other big thing, one last big thing for me here. Don't, if someone brings a list to you that you may not think is very good or maybe missing some components and, like, they're just trying to have fun with it or whatever it may be, right? Remember that your job as a human being isn't to help them have the best list. It's to help them if they want that help. I do this all the time and was recently told that I shouldn't do this all the time, and it really, like, hit home. Just remember when you're at your next steamroller, and that guy who always goes 0-5 comes up to you, and he's really excited about his Xerxes 2 list with double mammoth in it. not to just be like, wouldn't it be better with this instead? But to instead be like, oh man, what's exciting it about you? Because like at the end of the day, he left his house to come here and play games with people, and like he doesn't want to be shit on, right?
To his point though, how good is Double Mammoth? That seems pretty cool.
I mean, it's dope as fuck.
Well, I guess I'm thinking about like, oh, that seems not awful. Like blanket, you know, carpet bomb infantry, slam all my opponent's heavies away. And like,
well, not slam, Brad. Throw. Very big difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the same thing. I'm just going to do whichever's better for me in that situation. If it slams better, I'll slam. If it throws better, I'll throw. So I'll tell you how to play this game, Matt.
Oh, Jesus. All right. I guess I'll go fuck myself. But, like, I mean, like, we were talking about social contract and, like, being a sportsman and a member of the community and shit like that. Like, just be supportive of your friends. And, like, if he's not your friend, then, like, don't be supportive of him, I guess. I guess that's the message.
I feel like you got off base there somehow, Matt. But
I yeah, mean, I don't know what happened. all I can say is that one of my fondest memories of War Machine is at the Boker Brawl. I'm playing with the team Not Snakes Gaming, and we're going into our round, and I'm like, Pete, I need those models for Haley too. And Pete's like, hold on, Matt, I'll go get them for you. And then comes back with his head held low, and he goes, I forgot all of the models for your list. And I'm like, well, now I have to play a matchup that's really bad because I only have the models for Haley 3 for the rest of this tournament. And then I won. It was fine. But my favorite moment of all of that event was the watching Pete come over, just knowing that he didn't have the models to begin with, and just watching him just be destroyed as he walks over. Highlight of War Machine.
So I have successfully rat-fucked some of the top War Machine players out of models. Like, it's what I do.
It's great.
So between kind of the management of how to manage the clock and team events, I mean, our general kind of overarching theme today was like how important community is, right? Like if I just try and surmise the past hour that we've spent together, is like playing on teams is great because of the community of guys you get to go in with, like sharing a mindset and the run up to it. And then the clock management bit of while we are playing to win, like the community of which you're playing in is more important than that individual win. So like, I mean, I feel like that is what we've led up to right now is like, you know, the community of guys that you're going to surround yourself with, or community of players that you're going to surround yourself with is more important than a win and loss record. And it, a community is something to actively work towards, right? It's like something that we should all, you know, strive to have a strong community in. I mean, Pete and I are pretty lucky with where we're at. I think you're pretty lucky with the Montreal meta as well. But there are those that have shrinking or severely diminished metas. And for the players that are still in those areas, it's on to you guys to be there for each other and to, you know, welcome new guys into it. You know, if at all able.
Yeah, I think that the really big thing about War Machine communities in general is you need someone willing to put in the time and the effort to really, like, welcome new players and help them grow. I know for a long time, my meta was kind of struggling a little bit because, like, there wasn't really anyone there that was helping other people. And, like, there wasn't anyone who was really spending the time to help new players get better. And only, like, recently has like the community been growing. We were like having a really big return of like new players who were diminished, like they just didn't feel good about the game or whatever. And I think the big thing is that you need to have value in the game other than winning, because like Pete brought up like how in the US generally speaking there's only prize support for first, second, and third in tournaments during our talk before the show. And how, like, that's how things happen. And, like, in my local area, we do first, second prizing, and then we do raffles of a bunch of stuff. So, like, even if you're a casual player and go 0-4 or 5, depending on how many people we have, you still go home with, like, $30 most of the time. Like, you still go home with something, because, like, at the end of the day, We're here to have fun. Like, it feels bad to get told, like, because, like, not only did you get destroyed, but you also have no chance at, like, you just feel like you wasted your time, right? It feels really bad.
That's a really good idea. In terms of, like, the raffling after, like, a prize payoff first and second. I think I might adopt that.
It's how we do it. Like, our first and second place prizes are pretty diminished. Like, it's enough for a box. Like, when, like, getting first to the steamroller is really cool, but, like, getting $100 is this, like, it should be like $60 plus you get that remaining 40 goes to some guy who showed up to make the steamroller happen in the first place, right?
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that. I think that's great.
And I think that's just the way you do it.
The only one last thing, and Pete, I'm going to throw this to you, is while it might be common knowledge to some, the three of us, I think, all found out the way a rule works this past week that we all thought was interesting and wanted to share. But I already forgot how it worked again, so I need one of you two to tell me again.
Yeah, so the discussion at hand was using the Ruin Arcana or Arcane Vortex to eliminate the casting of Death Field from the Mercenary Solo Ragman. And so both of those abilities trigger when a model casts a spell that targets another model in whatever range of the effect.
Right, so it's a 3-4 Arcane Vortex within control area for Ruin.
Yeah, so what happens is typically four spells that don't have a range, let's say range self, you're actually targeting yourself. Now, the interesting thing with Ragman, and this has been confirmed on the rules forum, is that it doesn't target anything. It's just cast. So that spell is immune to Arcane Vortex and
Ruin.
So some interesting things in the how spells work section of the rulebook, it says step one to casting a spell is declare the target of the spell. So for like all of the year Grimkin came out, everyone was like, yeah, well, any spell that doesn't have a declared target is a range self spell. That's how everyone I played against, every convention I was a member of, like all of those things, that's how it worked. And apparently in 2018, it was Infernald that Deathfield and Craft Rune Thrall do not target at all. So they cannot be Arcane Vortex, they cannot be ruined. I don't think they can be stopped in any way. And like it's a lot of people. I can't count the number of games I played against Grimkin players that have ruined Ragman's Dark Shroud from me. I just didn't know that. Like, it changes so much. It's such an interesting interaction.
Is that true for basically all solos that have what we'd consider self-targeting spells? Like, I'm going to come back to Crix again, because that's what I can think of most readily. But, like, Dirgeseer's with Summon Vortex, does that target the Dirgeseer, or can I just Summon Vortex through Arcane Vortexes and Ruin?
I believe it targets the Dirgeseer.
Yeah, I'm going to open up War Room, so vamp for, like, 10 minutes. Yeah, I think there is a target as well. So, things that choose can't be ruined. So like the classic one is the brand new spell on the Grey Lord. They actually choose because it gets around spell ward on the Doom Reavers.
But specifically doesn't target for the purposes of like Arcane Vortex and Ruin?
I believe so, because it does not target. You choose a spell.
Is not targeting. Yeah. So yeah. Summon Vortex reads, center a 3-inch AoE cloud effect on this model. I have no idea. This is my answer. I don't know, Brad. I don't know if centering an AoE on a model is makes that model the target of the spell, or if the spell targets at all. I have no idea.
If Ragman is our precedent, like I would say no, right? Like it seems like any solo that has an ability that presumably would be self-targeted if it was a spell on a caster spell list is by definition not self-targeting, right? Like, did I say that correctly? Or
So unless it declares a target, it doesn't target, is what you're saying?
Right, so unless the spell specifically calls out, like on a spellcaster's spell list, range self, all solos with, like, effective range self spells are not range self for purposes of spell cancellation.
I would not make that leap. Because, like, the only two effects they called out were Dark Shroud and... or Death Field and Craft Thrall. So I'm assuming they would have had, like, a long laundry list of effects that this works on. This sounds like something we should probably get an Infernal or a Rules Forum list up and post after we record this episode.
Yeah, I mean, because, like, I feel like that list is got to be long of spells that don't specify target, like just staying in Crixus again, Beyond Death and Death Ride, both on Derig. Not Beyond Death, Mortal Fear now. What am I saying? That's Mark II. Like, both those effects are spells that any like, reasonably would be range self, but aren't called out as such because they're not written, you know, the range cost, you know, yeah. All that format.
I have no idea, Brad. This is a really complicated issue. I feel like I don't want to make an uneducated guess and give people misinformation.
I mean... yeah, at least though the only ones that show up in the Infernal ruling to work differently than all three of us presumed were Ragman and Alexia.
Yeah.
Which is like crazy. I mean, I know in a lot of my games right now that I've been playing in this Denegro and Slaughter Fleet, I would always try and keep Ragman outside of three from a Supreme Guardian, even if it defensive struck, just so it couldn't vortex off the death field.
Well, now you don't have to worry about that, Brad.
Right, I just get to do whatever I want.
Yep.
And, you know, I think the reason Arcane Vortex was never ruled on by a Infernal, who's really trying to prevent you from casting an Arcane Vortex? Arcane Vortex, right? It's more of, like, the Death Field is a spell that we absolutely want to prevent getting cast.
What?
What?
I didn't follow any of that.
Oh, I was saying no one's going to spend a ruin to get rid of that cloud.
Oh, Summon Vortex. Yeah,
Summon Vortex,
oh,
yes.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, no one's going to spend a Arcane Vortex or a ruin to prevent a Summon Vortex.
Sure, yeah, no, I agree with that part. Maybe the denying the cloud isn't the important bit here. I think, though, like, I play against a Grimkin player with ruin. I have two important upkeeps out. I'm just going to choose to upkeep those and not cast any spells on my spellcaster, right? I can put my spellcaster wherever, I can pop feet, they're not going to cast a spell. I now am going with, like, my units and souls or whatever. One of them casts a spell that you could trigger off of and then remove the upkeeps with it. Right? But, like, if Summon Vortex or any of the other spells that are, like, self-targeting but not in this weird, strange space we're in right now, if those are not something eligible to trigger ruin off of, I can now do those freely without worrying about you stripping upkeeps.
Yeah, this is a super complicated issue. I'm putting it here now. Let's get an infernal list of effects.
We're going to make Grant, when he posts this episode, of which we'll make him listen for this, I'll make sure he finds it. We're going to make Grant post up that people should let us know of spells that are presumably self-targeting on solos or units with magic abilities that don't specifically say the word target.
Agreed.
Legit.
Yeah, all right. With that, boys, anything else we want to hit on before we all go off into our own respective team tournaments?
I think we're good.
Yeah.
All right, well, speaking at least for myself, guys, thank you so much for listening, and hope you join us again next time.
Bye, folks.
Ta-ta for now.